If you're like me, there's nothing you dread more than a trip to the toilet paper store. The lines, the dizzying array of brands, the intimidating teen employees, the shoddy and overpriced products. The whole experience is a nightmare of awkward human interaction, stress, and embarrassment. All for the privilege of rubbing environmentally destructive wood pulp on your rear end. That's why the good people at Toilet Mail are offering a hassle-free way to get quality toilet paper delivered to your house for a reasonable price. Every month, Toilet Mail will send you a box of 50 individual squares of premium, high-thread-count silk toilet paper for less than a dollar a square. Now, if you've ever priced premium toilet paper, I don't have to tell you that's a heck of a good price. Will, Felix, and I all use Toilet Mail, and our trips to the bathroom have never been more fun. As an added bonus for the next week, if you log on to ToiletMail.com and enter the promo code CHAPO, you will get your first shipment of soft, absorbent, sustainably harvested toilet paper for half off. So log on to Toilet Mail and finally give your butt the treatment it deserves.
It's Chapo, everybody. Perhaps we've said in the past that we would never sell out, or it sort of runs counter to our sort of iconoclastic rebel image that we're portraying here. But folks, they drove a Brinks truck up to us and just unloaded the money. We're now brought to you by Toilet Mail, and we'll be doing promos for it throughout the show. But, you know, It's from the heart. It's us. We're not just putting anything out there. It's a product we use. It's a product we believe in.
We would never endorse something that we didn't think was a great product.
And Toilet Mail is exactly that product.
If you guys are like me, your high-protein diet has left you with an acidic stream of turds that frankly ruins your day. Feels like you're walking around with a salt and vinegar chip in between your asshole. What Toilet Mail has done is it's given us our lives back.
Thank you, Toilet Mail.
Chapo Trap House, a Toilet Mail partner.
I gotta tell you, this is just crazy, huh? This is just standard operating procedure to disparage me. That's fine. I don't know. Excuse me, Jeb. Jeb is a big fat mess. Okay. I gotta respond to this.
Okay, we're back. It's episode 22. The Deuce Deuce, everybody. It's me, Will Meniker, joined by Felix Biederman.
Hey, everybody.
And Matt Chrisman.
Sup, folks.
You may know we have an awesome guest for you this week, Vic Berger, the genius behind the Vines and YouTube compilations that I think have defined the 2016 election so far.
Vic is not a mess.
Vic is a gem. Vic is a genius, basically. And we had a great conversation with him. And the people are fiending for it, man. So I think we should just go straight into it. What do you guys say?
Let's do it.
Roll that Vic. Vic, thanks so much for talking to us. I think we should get the embarrassing part of this interview out of the way first, where I just shamelessly kiss your ass. But I do have to say that your Vines and sort of YouTube remixes of the debates were basically the only, I guess, televised coverage of this election that I follow. And I think that you've created what is the definitive portrait of the 2016 election. I think you should probably win the Pulitzer, Polk, and let's say Bancroft Awards as well.
Oh, that's
and
very
AVM.
Nice of you.
Don't forget that.
And, I'll take them all.
And Saudi Arabia's King Faisal Medal of Honor and Piety.
I would accept it gladly.
And I guess for a few of the squares who maybe aren't familiar with your the body of work that you've put out, but basically through Vine and YouTube, what you do is that you take video footage that's already there. And you tweak it by just about, I don't know, 5 to 10% to create these kind of amazing caricatures of the Republican candidates that I think completely captures their essence as human beings, or non-human beings in the case of Ted Cruz.
Right.
But that are also just as grotesque as any like Ralph Steadman drawing. So I guess to start, I'm interested – Like, how do you describe, like how do you approach creating one of these? What's your method? Like, how do you scan footage to come up with this kind of these gems?
Well, it usually starts with, like, if it's a debate video, you know, I'll watch the debate the night as it's airing, and then look for like, take notes during it and see what is awkward or what is just total, you know, bullshit, or, you know, where's somebody being phony, or worse, just looking for good footage, you know. And then like you said, I take it and tweak it, just not a ton, you know, just a little bit, like amp it up a bit and exaggerate certain moments. And I think it does boil them down to their essence in a way, you know, just it makes them just a more slightly more cartoony candidate, I guess, you know. I kind of settled in politics where I am right now because there's so much footage available and there's so much material. Before I started doing video, I mean, I paid attention to politics generally, but now not as much, you know, as I'm doing now. And I kind of just gravitated towards it because of the material, you know, how much is it, the abundance of it.
You go where the gold is, right?
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Some of my favorite things you do are when you have a candidate who's more of a blank slate than the sort of inhuman freakishness of Cruz or the bombastic yelling of Trump. Like, those are, you know, I love those. But the two ones I really remember are what you did with Martin O'Malley at the Democratic town hall.
Hi.
Hi. Good evening.
Hi.
Hi. Your history as mayor of Baltimore and governor of Maryland show that you pushed...
Hi.
...that you pushed for zero tolerance policing.
Let's talk about this. Check out my plan on my website. MartinO'Malley.com.
And the Kasich video where you sort of loop all of his media appearances and he's just sort of yelping into the darkness.
Yeah.
And
I don't ever look at what anybody else is doing. I don't look to distinguish myself. I'm John Kasich.
I got no attention, man.
I was wondering, like, with those two, it seems like you create more of a grand narrative about sadness or weirdness of these candidates.
Yeah, because I mean, with somebody like Trump, it's clear what the angle will be. You know, you're going to be this horrible, scary clown guy. And with Jeb, it was pretty clear that he's this pathetic guy.
A mess.
You know, he's a mess.
Well, I want you to apologize to my wife.
Yeah, right. Just like... Yeah, so those guys are more just like a summation of, if that's a word, of what I see with them. Because there wasn't a direct, there's nothing that really jumps out at me for as far as those two guys or people like that are just kind of like a blank slate. So I just pick moments that were funny and kind of create the character that way. And like O'Malley comes across as kind of just like this stud guy, you know, just like real handsome, you know, and that's the ladies like him. That's kind of where I went with that.
he plays in a band.
Yeah, he plays in a band. He's like, he's like this cool dad or whatever, you know. And Kasich was just, he's pathetic in a way that he stayed in and thought he was going to win, and because he was so happy he won Ohio and that was his thing. But it was clear he wasn't going to go anywhere else, and he was just begging for attention, and he would even say, like, I don't get any attention, man, you know, or whatever it was, you know, the line.
My favorite Kasich cut from you is in one of the debate remixes where you just kept looping him going, "Let's stop fighting, fighting,"
right. Like he's gonna bring everybody together.
I always imagine him hollering in his driveway at kids who are driving by too fast on their bikes or something.
And I always say his line, "Geez, oh man," like whenever something is like something goes wrong. That I say that way too much in my life.
Yeah, I bet geez, that if he ever swears in private life, he doesn't like that guy in Fargo who gets mad at Jerry Lundegaard for making him buy the true coat, and his eyes like pop open, like he can't believe he's saying it.
You're
a fucking liar, Mr.
Undergar. The angle that I always saw with O'Malley, like with Kasich, for Kasich, I saw him as a mix between like Matt always has talked about that he's sort of like the dad who just randomly talks to you in Home Depot and won't shut up. Has a weird positive energy about him. But O'Malley, you kind of captured this. He's like the bad husband in a Lifetime movie. Like, he's the guy who's gaslighting his wife. He's like, I own all the courts in Maryland. Yeah.
That's funny you said that about Kasich, because there's a video of him ordering, like, breakfast at a diner, and he's actually sitting in a booth with a couple that you can clearly tell that like they do not want him there, and it's just going on and on, and he's annoying the waitress with his jokes, and the jokes that they don't make any sense, like everything is, and he just goes on and on and on.
So, I saw him speak in New Hampshire, and he told this bizarre story about riding a horse when he was a kid, and this poor kid having a swollen eye, and then meeting the guy who owned the horse and him being a milkman. It was like, it was fucking Lynchian. And the moral of the story used to be that, like, we used to have communities.
Oh, man.
Well,
that's great.
Creating these little mythologies for each of these candidates have been, especially the ones that are a little bit more minor, has been, I think, one of the funnest things that we've done throughout the campaign. And like we were saying, John Kasich has this kind of dad quality to him, but also we've created this whole narrative that he's actually the king of the hobos as well, and his campaign was just going state to state while being pursued by like railroad detectives and things like that.
Just but trying what about to get a hot meal.
Ben Carson, I sort of had this idea about him that he was the hero of like a Dan Brown novel or one of the National Treasure movies, and that his campaign was like, he was traveling the country, but he was just following the secret treasure map that he found to discover Thomas Jefferson's like secret religious constitution that will make America Christian again or something like that.
I wanted to ask about specifically about one video, because I know a lot of your best stuff comes from these from the debates, but then you use a lot of sort of stray B-reel from just campaign stops. And the one that really fascinated me was in your epic obituary for Jeb. Was when he pets the pet moose, the big moose, and he just goes, that's good little, little moose.
Good little moose.
How did you find that? And B, what did you think when you saw it for the first time?
Oh man, I had like alerts set up for any time Jeb's people would post a video because I knew there'd be gold in it, and that was I got an alert and I click on that, and it's just like a compilation of like everything he's done, I guess, you know, all throughout the trail and everything, and then there's one scene all of a sudden like 3 minutes into it, and that's where the moose was, and it's really only like a 4 second clip, you know what I mean? But I used that and I just like, I was dying. I knew that was going to be big. Unbelievable. Because, like, he stares at the camera like he doesn't know what to say at first. And then, you can imagine, like his people, like, with the camera, like, just, like, shaking their hands. Like, just say something. Just do whatever, you know. And then you're a good little moose. You know?
Campaign's like, yeah, we got to keep that in. Talk to the moose.
Well, that's the thing. He does all these awkward things. And then he has these people that are supposed to, like, take care of him and make him look good. But whoever he's trusting is like, they're like working against him or something.
In the sort of farewell to Jeb compilation, my favorite clip in that is one where he's like, he's in the passenger side seat of a car and they're pulling out of a parking lot he just looks out the window and goes, I love keeping America safe.
Yeah.
it was almost like every time that he just like, he barely squeaked out something that sounded like a sentence. He's like, yeah, still got it.
Yeah.
Well, this brings me to the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is that probably a year ago, it was received wisdom that Jeb Bush was definitely going to be the Republican nominee, right?
Right.
Like, you know, it was set in stone. It was going to be Bush Clinton again. And then, like, as the year started and, like, Trump started, like, you know, percolating more and more, like the media and I think a lot of, I don't know, movement conservatives just simply could not believe that Trump would ever get as far as he did, much let alone become the Republican nominee.
Right. I think Trump thought that too.
I don't think he wanted to, really. But I got to say, anyone who was following you and watching your vines, it surely was not a surprise to them why he was able to wash the entire Republican field.
Yeah.
So right. I guess what do you see in Trump that like everyone else in the media missed about why this guy got, you know, was able to dominate as much as he has?
I think it's mainly that he just doesn't apologize. He will say these outlandish things that he knows will get press, and he doesn't care who he hurts. You know, along the way, he's taking cuts at every race, every religion. You know, just women, everything. And when people call him on it, if they do call him on it, he doesn't apologize. I mean, the closest he ever came to apologizing was in that Megyn Kelly thing, like that big, you know, interview that they had together after he tweeted all these horrible things about her. And she like called him on it, and he didn't say sorry. He said, "Excuse me," you know, like that's like what, like that's the only time I've ever heard him apologize. And I think it's that, and he just powers through, and because you know the news has to move on, so they can only linger on it so long, and we tend to forget or just let it go, just give him a pass. I think I don't, you know.
For me, the thing that like really encapsulates Trump in the videos you make, the thing that, like, for me, I think of it now when I ever see him on TV, is the air horn.
Yeah.
And because I feel like that, just that element of the videos, just throwing that in there, peppering it in, just encapsulates the entire Trump phenomenon in a way. And I was just wondering where the genesis of the air horn came from.
Well, that started about a year ago when he was giving some, he was doing some rally, and the crowd was just so loud, and it just reminded me of a sports, like arena, like a football game or something. And I thought, like, what else would you have, you know, in the crowd and at a football game or something, you know, but somebody with an air horn. And it's like, you know, it's an extension of Trump, in a way that he can bully, you know, bully the other candidates with the air horn.
No, it's just that thing of like, yeah, he never apologizes. And you know, he's just over and over again, I'm going to win. I'm going to be great. Yeah. We're going to be strong. And then just savagely belittling everyone else around him is amazing. And the other thing that I love, and it really comes across in the debate videos, both the actual debates and your sort of remixes of them, is the thing that's amazing is that Trump, he just wings it the entire, has not prepared at all, which is in stark contrast to a guy like Ted Cruz, who comes up there with his like canned debate team, you know, talking points and little, you know, he has his sort of canned lines that he knows he's going to hit, and it comes across terribly. Yeah. And Trump just gets up there, and like no matter what question they ask him, they'll be like, "Oh, Mr. Trump, what do you think of trade with the Pacific Rim or something?" And he just gets up there like a kid who hasn't done the homework. But instead of like seeming like he's drowning like Marco Rubio or something, he just keeps talking with that completely unearned confidence and just powers through in a way that I think people relate to, because I think people hate a know-it-all, but they don't want someone to seem like they're weak or don't know what they're doing. And he manages to do both at the same time. He doesn't know what he's talking about, but he never seems weak. He always seems, has that utmost confidence.
Exactly. Yeah. He doesn't prepare at all. And, people like that. People like the confidence. That's number one with him. I think they just like, even if he's saying bullshit, he's saying nothing. If he does it in a confident way, which he does, people follow, like, they like that. But then others, I think, like me and every other, the people that hate him, like, they hate that. So it's just like, I don't know, it's just a bizarre thing. I don't know.
I mean, I think a big thing with Trump is, in America, I think we're oddly informed by religion. We're oddly informed by the type of Protestantism, the type of Calvinism that we were founded on as a nation. But the other thing that informs our culture, the sort of middle American culture where Trump thrives, is sports. It's like the language of sports. And I think the reason that Trump does so well is he talks like an athlete. Like, he talks in these great, like, victory, victory, victory. We're going to win. We're going to win. We're going to win. We're going to do great. And everyone, you know, people always talked up Marco's career as an athlete, which really wasn't that impressive, but compared to the inbred freaks that make up the Senate,
Hey, Marco is married to a cheerleader, okay? Miami Dolphins cheerleader.
I didn't know that. I mean,
yeah, well, and Marco does have kids at the rate of that NFL guy. But allegedly. But Trump really got that, whether he meant to or not. He was sort of a savant for that language of victory that people like.
Yeah,
and I think that's why I like the air horn so much, because it's like, yeah, he's like Jim Harbaugh or something.
Yeah, because he's promoted so many boxing matches, you know, in his days in Atlantic City. So I think some stuff rubbed off of him. Like, you know, like what's his name? Don King is a supporter of his, too. So
yeah,
he's a close friend. Tyson, even, yeah.
I got to say, though, like, I mean, his his Carnival Barker sports entertainment side is really obviously informing him a lot and helping him. But I gotta say, I'm a little disappointed that he can't sell a stunner very well. he famously got stunned by Stone Cold Steve Austin back during the Attitude era of the WWF, and it sucked. He could not do it. And I feel like if you can't sell a stunner, how the hell are you going to think you're going to lead a nation?
I mean, only when an actual pro wrestler becomes president will we live up to the promises of the Constitution.
Jesse Ventura is still out there, man.
Yeah.
He's going
to be speaking at the convention, actually.
Which convention?
I think he's coming to the GOP convention, isn't he?
Really? I thought Jesse Ventura hated the Republicans.
I don't know. I thought I read that. Maybe not.
He calls them Rethuglicans, I believe.
Oh, man.
Got him. I'm surprised they won any fucking elections after that.
Yeah. So, for me, obviously, I think the interplay between Trump and Jeb was definitely the funniest thing that you've done in this campaign, of just, you know, the alpha daddy putting the weak beta in his place over and over again, and just the pathos of Jeb just getting further and further away from his dreams as they all just slip away from him.
Yeah.
That is hysterical. But by far the most disturbing thing that you've done in this election is the Ted Cruz stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, like I said, you take what's already there and you kind of create this hyper reality by tweaking it by about 5 to 10%. Mm. I didn't think it would be possible to make Ted Cruz 5 to 10% more abominable without shattering our fragile sanity. But you did just that. And the one I want to ask you about right away, it's the one that is absolutely the most memorable one. The Vine you did of Ted Cruz at the gun range, where he's he unloads like a submachine gun, and then you do like the farting sounds, and then he just has this utterly inhuman cackle at the end of it. Like, where did you find that video, man?
Well, that was originally something with, I think it's Independent Journal Review, IJ Review.
Oh, great.
Who, a fine outfit. I came across them when they were doing all these videos with the candidates, just to like all the Republican candidates, to try and make them look cool, you know.
Benny
and
Johnson
it was just
getting paid.
Benny Johnson. He was the first one to contact me, actually, when I did the fake Jeb tattoo thing.
Oh,
he
really?
Was the first. He wanted to do the whole story. Yeah, but I told him it was a fake. But
he bought it. He believed.
Yeah, he bought it. Right away.
Wait a minute. Ben Johnson is a credulous dullard. This can't be the same guy I'm thinking of.
Dude, breaking news, really, folks. Breaking news on Chapo.
It's really hard to get one over on old Benny.
Yeah.
For people who don't know, BuzzFeed assigned Benny Johnson to write about Fort Hood a year after the shooting, and he was like, he literally just wrote about the restaurants that were there.
So that was the video of Ted Cruz at a gun range was essentially one done by a very sympathetic outlet with the intention of making him seem cool and relatable.
That is
horrifying.
Yeah, but they thought it was funny to have him cook bacon with a machine gun. So
epic.
Yeah, so he shoots this gun and then he laughs because it's he loves it so much, and then he looks at the bacon and then laughs again because it's cooked and everything. But I just took the most like terrifying moments of that, and actually he's staring at the camera for less than a second, but I just looped it, so he's like staring. He might be staring for 2 seconds in the Vine, which is like horrible looking into his eyes.
Too much, man.
Yeah, it's way too many seconds. and then he turns and then shoots at this target, and then the bacon stripping and everything. But then, and also then he has this horrible cackle, like you said, and I pitch shifted that a little bit just to make it a little even creepier. And
like, I feel like your best stuff comes from this material that the candidates themselves put out as essentially a positive, saleable image of themselves.
Yeah.
And the other
I love that stuff
that comes to mind about Ted Cruz that he put out there again is that video of him eating dinner with his family.
Oh my god.
Oh my god.
Well, he put out about 20 hours of video on YouTube of him walking with his family, and you know, there's all this like stock footage of like him, and there's flags and all this nonsense that he uploaded to like a secret YouTube channel. Actually, no, it wasn't even secret. It was like his old Senate channel or something like that. And he put it up there so his super PAC could download it that way. So, there's, you know, because they're not supposed to have any contact with each other. I think Andrew from BuzzFeed, I think, reported on it first. And then so then I immediately saw it and then downloaded all these like 20 hours of footage. And in it, it was supposed to be the sound was supposed to be off. But during the dinner scenes, the sound on the camera was still on, and I guess they never muted it or whatever. So I was able to get him praying with his kids and his kids praying and just doing multiple takes of praying. And then they had they probably just brought a bag of salad along, you know, in this home. It's just like chopped. It's like a green, like a head of lettuce or something.
Yeah. And the thing you did in that video that was, so that honestly, it almost killed me. It's a tiny moment, but where you run the video backwards so it looks like the lettuce is coming out of their mouths.
Yeah,
I couldn't take it, man. And then the weirdest thing is that his two daughters like can't stand him.
Oh yeah,
it's obvious they cannot. Yeah, I really feel bad for them. They hate him.
And yeah, people have given
the tell-all book that those kids are going to write in a few years.
Oh yeah.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, totally. And people have given me shit for like involving them in my videos, but it's I'm not going after them. You know, it's Ted who's putting them out there and making them deliver the lines. And like he made them in one video, he made them attack Hillary Clinton, like calling her a witch. I don't know if you ever saw that, but it's like,
no, I didn't see that.
And I feel bad for those girls, and I'm definitely not going after them. I'm going after Ted, you know?
So, yeah.
So that's one complaint that people
have given. Do you think that he does like the Leno impression at the dinner table?
I'm sure he does so many impressions.
The thing I love about that is when you get them all together, all of him doing that joke, and he's got the same like cadence, and it's all terrible.
Yeah,
and, and no one ever laughs.
No one ever
but he
does.
Keeps doing it.
Yeah, over
him.
And over.
He laughs.
Oh yeah, he loves it. Yeah, definitely. And he just doesn't pick up on that. I don't know. He's like, doesn't he? You would think after doing it two or three times, you'd be like, no one's really getting this. But let's just power through and keep going.
I mean, I think he weighs it against the usual blank stares and physical disgust and that he gets when he does most things.
Yeah,
he's like, all right, no screaming.
Yeah,
this one's a winner.
I will do this one again.
This is what we mentioned earlier about Ted Cruz, is that he comes from this debate team culture.
Yeah.
And like he just has like, it's so canned, like, you know, like and then the other thing you do is that you capture the throwaway reactions that you just zoom in on that would be missed in other media. And in the Ted Cruz one where he's the guy, Iowa's Steve King, another absolute gem, is standing right behind him. And Ted Cruz is going through his lines, and Steve King is mouthing it along with him. Ted Cruz is going, he's dividing us on economic lines, on racial lines, on gender lines, on religious lines. And then you just zoom in on Steve King, and he's just nodding along, mouthing the words. It's so even odd. And you can just tell the both of them. And maybe they wrote it together, and they're just so happy with that cut.
They
he's
love
like, "Oh,
it.
You're hitting every point here, man!"
Right? And he's probably going on the road with them like that week or whatever, and just getting so used to it. Or I was thinking he also might have been looking at the teleprompter, you know, or something. Yeah. I don't. It was so, but he was also doing the same hand gestures as Cruz, which doesn't make any sense.
It was like one of those YouTube lip sync videos.
Yeah,
it's the worst version.
It definitely shows one of the reasons people prefer Trump, because nobody could do that at a Trump rally.
Right.
You have no idea what he's going to say from one moment to the next. So it's more entertaining.
Right.
It's more vital. Yeah. Also, on that tip of zooming in on someone else's reaction, the one moment from a Vine that'll haunt me probably to my death is from the Mike Huckabee rib Vine.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
You pin in on the weird large son behind him. Not his large son, somebody else's large son. And he's talking about the wet ribs, and he just starts licking his lips.
Yeah.
Oh, God. That was like that. That everyone in that video who is just sort of an equally lumpy, large man. Yeah.
Honestly, it's like that looked like that whole thing seemed like a deleted scene from one of the later Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies.
And there's a tall guy in the back with a bolo tie on.
Okay, as long as we're talking about these throwaway reactions, my absolute favorite one that you got was the clip of. It was Steve Crowder on stage with Milo and Christina Hoff Sommers, and they're on some kind of campus tour.
Yeah.
And Milo and Based Mom are sitting in these chairs, these big like sort of plush couches on the stage or whatever. And Crowder is standing up, and he's fully torqued.
They're confused. You know why? Because I'm not your gender studies professor who has to cater to your trigger warning, microaggression, safe space bullshit. Oh, I'm a racist. There you go. That's a new one. Where'd you learn that one? In Social Human Studies 101? This chick is a...
Yeah. He's fully torqued. He's just going back and forth, screaming at the audience, going and pointing at Milo and going, you see this, man? This is your worst nightmare. This is what you've created. Yeah. And then you just zoom in on Milo for a half second. Yeah. Just looks at Christina like, can you believe this asshole?
Yeah. Crowder is one of my least favorite people. Like, yeah. I didn't, you know, like up until like 6 months ago, I had no idea who he was. But then somebody tagged me in something that he posted on Twitter, and I looked at it, and then of course I had to watch his videos, and they're all just like designed to offend people, and they don't really help anything. They don't even help his position. You know, they're just
yeah. Like his entire comedic conceit is like, well, liberals say they're tolerant,
yeah,
but what happens when I pretend to suck my friend's cock?
Yeah.
In right. school, and it's like, well, why?
Right,
like,
what? Right, exactly. Like, why?
What
yeah.
are you doing?
And the people that he like, he'll like crash like a feminist meeting or something, and just get in people's faces about it, and no one, and people are always like really nice to him.
Well, his entire thing with Amy Schumer is like he went on Red Eye back before Amy Schumer was as popular as she is now. And he was trying to make some stupid point about abstinence, like saving your virginity until marriage,
oh, yeah.
which I don't give a shit if anyone does or doesn't. But he said something, he like said something shitty to Amy Schumer, and Amy Schumer just straight up goes, you're not a comedian. Which is right.
It is.
It's yeah, completely true. Correct. And he was just, it sucked the air out of the room, and he did that thing where he, duh, 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 yeah. like he's out of shit. He's out of shit.
Yeah.
That he knows how to
like
say.
He got let go.
Hit him in his insecurity.
He got,
and he's been talking about it for 4 fucking mm-hmm. years.
He got let go from Fox News, and then like when it happened, they got like some, a source in the Fox News PR department just said he's not very funny. Like, and that's Fox yeah. News. That's a low bar.
That's the channel yeah. that broadcasts the half-hour news hour.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, there's some good shit on there, though.
Well, yeah, well, here's my Steve Crowder YouTube challenge for anyone out there. Find footage of any one of Steven Crowder's stand-up performances of him being funny. Find any any footage of anyone laughing at any one of Steve Crowder's jokes in any kind of stand-up.
Well, he's found a nice niche because a lot of an incredible amount of conservative practice comes down to enduring things just on this premise that they annoy liberals. So I just imagine people kind of forcing themselves to go to a Steve Crowder show and just like enduring it, but being like, yep, I got to do this. Yeah. It pisses off the libs. And so that kind of gives them an audience of just sort of semi-voluntary people.
It's the same with the audience who watches Red Eye. They're like, I'm staying up till 4:30 to watch this, God damn it! I need this. We need this. We need to build this movement. Vic, the last thing I wanted to ask you, just sort of on the political tip, is, like, you know, what do you see going forward for you and, like, the general election? And specifically, Hillary Clinton has been, I think, mostly absent from your output. And, like, how do you feel about her? Is she just really hard to satirize? That's kind of how I feel about her.
I think she is. She's so professional, and she doesn't really mess up a whole lot. I've done stuff with her, but not as much because the material just isn't as strong, you know? And if she does something that is usable, everybody jumps on it, and I don't really want to repeat that? You know what I mean? Like say, like she does the dog bark thing. You see that everywhere then, you know? And but I think it's just, I just don't find her as funny, you know what I mean? And it's not because I'm biased or I don't want to, like, hurt her or anything, you know what I mean? Because I'm not, like, out there trying to promote any candidates. I'm just going where the material is, and it's just not as strong. And my boss at Super Deluxe wants me to, you know, try and tackle the Democrats a little more, but it's just not as clear which route to go, you know?
I mean, by any objective measure, politics aside, the Republicans are just such a richer vein of material.
Yeah, it really is. And Trump is like nothing that's ever happened before. And the material is just constant and it's always insane. And there's always something funny or, you know, dark that's going on with him. And even like, you know, compared to, you know, any other Republican, like Romney, it just doesn't compare to what Trump is. Trump's like on another level, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know? It's a hard job for any comedian, man. And I don't envy the task. I think Kate McKinnon has done a really good job on Saturday Night Live, but that's a hard hand to be dealt to play with.
Yeah,
Hillary Clinton. You know, I mean, like the one that stands out for me is just her going, I'm chilling in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. But like, yeah, that's it. Like, that's the only funny thing, really.
That is right. If she did more stuff like that, but I think she just hired the right people to keep her away from doing too much of that. Cause
yeah, she's very, very like controlled.
Her fans do embarrassing stuff online all the time. But
I know,
she always like has a nice remove and sort of a plausible deniability for the more embarrassing to be millennial and things like that.
Definitely.
The coolest thing I saw Hillary guy do online was is this guy who would go to the gym and he would play like top 40 songs over him doing fucking battle ropes or push-ups, but he would title the videos like "Workout for Hillary." Fuck you, Bernie. I was like, this is so cool. Like, this guy rules. Yeah.
Are you going to be able to get on the floor at the conventions, or are you going to be talking to people coming in and out? What do you think?
Well, we were denied press passes for the GOP, so we're gonna be like a mile and a half away in the First Amendment zone, which is great because they're, you know, protesting a mile and a half away from the arena. That's really gonna help. But yeah, we're gonna be out there with the crazies. We might have a guy inside the arena. Well, I won't say his name yet, but
are
he might
going,
be in there.
Wait, are you going with Tim Heidecker?
Yeah, I'm going with Tim.
Please tell me he's going to do Decker the entire time.
Oh man, I hope so. I hope we'll do some of that, but he's not planning on being on the camera too much. You know what I mean? He's going to be, but he's not going to be in character.
Okay,
But he might do his own thing on the side or whatever. But we're going, you know, we're going to be talking to the protesters, and we have some connections at like CNN to get into like the CNN grill or whatever, talk, see who's in there. But also on the 18th, there's this insane rally going on put on by Roger Stone.
Oh, I love that guy.
Yeah. And guy. Alex Jones is going to be there.
Oh God. He's gonna, yes.
But do you know who Diamond and Silk are?
Who are they?
There are a couple of African American women who do pro Trump YouTube videos.
Oh wait, yeah, now I know who they are.
And I'm pretty sure that they're funded by Trump. I'm pretty sure he's paying them to do that because it's insane. But it's put on. It's sponsored by these white nationalist organizations.
Oh my God!
And these white, you know, these white genocide people, which I don't even totally understand, but I guess they think that the government's trying to get rid of the white race. Is that what that means? I don't.
Well, they mean genocide, but over the course of the next like 300 years.
Okay.
The government is basically encouraging miscegenation with the goal of eliminating white people. That's the
thing. Right. Yeah, that's where the whole cuck thing comes in. That anything short of like putting a moat of lava around any borders is like, well, I want an immigrant to fuck my wife to get rid of the white race.
Yeah.
Which like, yes, like true of some of us. But like everyone gets married for different reasons and it's not really your business.
Yeah. Before we go, I do want to touch on briefly. I mean, we talked a lot about the politics but that's really only half of your creative output. And you do a lot of other stuff as well that is equally hysterical. And I want to talk briefly about I have to about Jim Baker and the Baker Buckets videos.
Definitely.
I have shown these videos to many people. It's sort of like if I meet you for the first time, I say, hey, you got a second? Come over to this computer. I want to show you something. But almost universally, people do not believe that it's real. Like, right. They think that this is like made up or something. But I have to assure them that Jim Baker is 100% real. And really, Jim Baker was the example of crooked televangelists from the 80s. He was really famous back in the day, but now he's made sort of a comeback. Now he's got a new wife and he's got a new show. Mm-hmm. And what do you say? Like, it's a show, but it's really an excuse to sell this like survival food. Basically.
Yeah, it's an infomercial basically for survival food. Like when Jesus comes back and the world's going to hell, where the apocalypse is going on, this will help you through that time. And this, you'll have food in a plastic bucket that you can pour boiling water into. It's like dried food in packets, and you put boiling water on it, and you can eat that with your family.
It's an amazing grift, though, because on every episode of the show, and I've seen the show I've actually watched the show like unadulterated, and every episode. It just underscoring to his audience over and over again, he'll pick any news item and connect it to like that the apocalypse is going to happen any day now. Like everything is just evidence that the world is spinning out of control. Everything's going to fall apart. And then what, you know, you're going to want to stick to you and your family and you're going to want to have your food. You need to have your food. And what he's selling basically is, I don't know. Yeah. Like powdered milk and like animal feed. But it's insanely expensive. It's like $2,000 or something.
It's
like
very
that.
Expensive. And he's even gotten to the point where he must have all these like extra buckets that he's selling buckets of Bibles. he has like all the, and you know, there's like 100 Bibles in there. And then also he got to a point where he has so many buckets sitting around. He's like, hey, you can use this as furniture now. And he puts like a piece of plywood on it and he makes a table. It's unbelievable. But a couple days ago, I got a message from somebody and there was a video attached to it. And it was from inside the Jim Baker control room. And it was just during a taping. And I like investigated a little bit to see who this person was. It turns out it was Jim Baker's grandson. And he's a fan of my work.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's really, really incredible. And I mean, he wasn't like mad at me or whatever. He says I'm a big fan, you know. So he must get it, you know.
My favorite thing about the Jim Baker buckets is, like, okay, so you're supposed to eat them when the Book of Revelation, when everything in the Book of Revelation happens. But, like, A, are you supposed – that's the Day of Judgment. Like, you're supposed to be happy. Like, God is going to anoint the righteous. Like, what happens? Like, you – so, like, God kills everyone on earth, but you survive because you have a bucket of broccoli and cheese.
Yeah.
Do you get, like, a second heaven? There's no fucking planet Kolob in evangelical Christianity.
Well, yeah, I mean, aren't they supposed to reward? Believe in the rapture? Like, before anything bad happens, they're all supposed to get instantly taken to heaven. And so I can just imagine them getting sucked to heaven. They're like, no, my bucket!
Yeah.
$2,000 for that!
Yeah.
There will be cheesy broccoli in heaven, though, for sure. In just preparing for this, actually, this is an interesting bit of Jim Baker trivia. Now, like I said, as I mentioned before, famously in the 80s, he was convicted. It said he was convicted of 8 counts of mail fraud and 15 counts of wire fraud and 1 count of conspiracy. He was sentenced to federal prison for 45 years. I don't think he served even a fraction of that.
No, it might have been 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. So he went – one of these famous guy, crooked televangelists, he went to prison, then came out and was like, I've sinned, but now I'm redeemed. Here's the interesting bit of trivia. Take a guess. He was incarcerated at the Federal Medical Center in Rochester, Minnesota. Take a guess who his cellmate was in the 80s. None other than Lyndon LaRouche.
Yo, winner's circle, baby. Fucking winner's circle.
That's a sitcom.
And he had the – after Disney World, he had the number 2 largest theme park in the country for a number of years. Yeah, it was like it was the second biggest theme park.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Jim Baker still killing it.
On that grind.
Finally, before we let you go, the one other thing I got to ask about – again, maybe as disturbing or just soul deadening as any of the Ted Cruz videos is your Jimmy Fallon videos. It's just your clips from The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
What is up with Jimmy Fallon? Why does he laugh so much at everything?
Hey, I'm Italian too. Hey, so I said to him, you know.
I think it's mainly he just wants everyone to like him. You know, he's just got that personality that he has to be liked by everybody, and he wants to show that he likes you and he thinks you're funny or whatever. My main problem with him is that he lets all these presidential candidates like Trump and like on both sides come on, and then they have like an open floor. But he just lets them, it's like a platform for them to say whatever they want. And he's like best buds with Chris Christie. And they got that whole thing going on. You know what I mean?
It's just embarrassing.
Yeah. And he's on a lot. Christie's on like way too much talking about Bruce Springsteen and whatever. It's just like they can use that to control their image. And I don't know if Carson would have done that. I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen too much Carson. It's a little before my time, but I would assume that Carson would not be happy where the show is.
I don't think Carson or even. I mean, look, The Tonight Show is always, you know, a platform for the guests to look good, right? That's how people wanted to come on the show. But I don't think Carson or even Leno would laugh as loudly and obnoxiously at every single thing a guest says, you know, like the Ted Cruz one where like Ted Cruz like, well, I wanted to be a starting point guard for the Lakers, but it didn't work out. And Jimmy was like, no, it didn't, man.
Very forced. And it sounds almost painful at times.
No, it does sound. It sounds like, like it must, his ribs are, you know.
The real test would be if we could get Cruz to do the Jay Leno joke to Fallon.
If Fallon laughed
at that, then he probably has some sort of brain damage.
Fallon would eat that shit up. It's like when puppies, when they're under a year old, they eat their own shit because they see their parents do it. Yeah. They see like the bitch of the litter doing it. It'd be the same shit.
If you like it, Dad, you can keep it.
All right, Vic. I think we should leave it there. But best of luck at the Republican convention.
Thank you.
And we will definitely be following leading up to the general. I hope the material stays as gold as it's been throughout the Republican primary. But once again, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having
me. Your stuff is hilarious.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back. So that was Vic Berger. Thanks so much again to him for joining us. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Now, we mentioned in the Vic Berger interview, we talked a little bit about John Kasich, one of our favorite characters here on Chapo, and some of the mythologies that have been created to sort of fill in the gaps of the Kasich biography. What accounts for a man such as John Kasich? What is the measure of a man, of a Kasich? Is a question we ask ourselves.
Well, I think that it's everyone having it out for you, high yield bottle deposits, and evading the yard ticks.
Well, I got to give a shout out to a listener, a friend of the show, on Twitter at PG Wokehouse. PG Wokehouse sent me this week the table of contents from John Kasich's first book. The name of the book is Courage is Contagious. And he wrote this when he was still a congressman from Ohio. And it's billed as sort of a modern day profiles in courage. And it says, you know, Congressman John Kasich profiles 20 men and women from across the country who have, through their own courage, determination, and generous hearts, attempted to improve the lot of their fellow citizens. And he sent me the table of contents from this book, and it is hilarious. So I'm hoping we can go through them right now. So this is the table of contents from John Kasich's book, Courage is Contagious. Chapter 3, The Best Medicine.
Nightbird.
And if you can't get your hands on any of that, Sterno works in a pinch.
And when I was reading these, I was just amazed at how well – every one of these fit into the template that we already have for John Kasich.
I mean, for people who don't know the real history of John Kasich, he was an investment banker for Lehman Brothers. He was a congressman for many, many years. But, like, fuck you, bitch, you're a drifter now. You're a drifter because the first time I saw John Kasich, I was like, he looks like he slept in his car. And now tens of thousands of people think that, and they're going to think it forever. Because it's true now. Our timeline is the real timeline.
And we bent it to our will after he was seen scrounging free meals from every restaurant in New York City. It was finally confirmed for everyone.
There is a chapter called A Lump in the Throat. This is one of my favorites. There's a chapter called You Don't Know How Much I Hate Drugs.
Literally something you would say while you're asking somebody $45 for a Greyhound ticket.
I'll tell you right now, sir, there's no way I'm going to use this for any drugs. Sir. You have no idea how much I hate drugs, sir.
I'm clean for 53 days.
I've seen it do some bad things in the hobo jungle. I want no part of it.
This next chapter, again, so perfect. It's called A Sandwich for Millie.
This isn't for me. It's for Millie.
I got a sandwich for Millie. Who is this Millie? She's a woman of courage. And John Kasich gave her a sandwich. He gave him one of the spare sandwiches that he has on him at all times, just in his pocket.
God bless
you.
He's
like, oh, this is a tuna fish. Here, have it. Next chapter, Welcome to the Spot. The Spot capitalized. He's like, welcome to the spot. You're in the spot now.
Empty caboose car.
Next chapter is called I Want to Save the World.
You know, that's the kind of thing that if someone told me that in earnest, I would be like, you know what? You should never be anywhere near any level of power ever.
Yeah, you're psychotic.
You are a terrifying creature.
Next chapter, Demanding Excellence. He's speaking, of course, of his son's Little League team. He's a coach. He's a player.
John Kasich is the type of guy who, usually this is the province of heavy cocaine users, but totally stone cold sober, will burst into tears and talk about how much an 8-year-old third baseman inspires him.
The base, next chapter, the base sentimentality of fascism and display in the character of John Kasich.
The next chapter, I swear to God, I'm not making this up, is called The Cookie Lady. I can only imagine. I can only imagine what that's like.
Type of Christian. God bless you, ma'am.
The next chapter, somewhat ominously, is called Something Had to Be Done.
Oh, God.
No. Oh, no.
Oh, dear God.
Johnny.
What did you do, Johnny? John, what did you do?
The next chapter is called Schools on Wheels. I don't know. Again, it sounds so hobo shit. This is such hobo shit. Yeah. He's like,
this is like the hobo Quran.
Schools on Wheels is like when your dad, or the man at least who you called dad, was taking you around Depression era America in like a Studebaker. It was like Paper Moon, basically. and you learn the tricks of like the grift, just being driven around. He's like, that car was better than any school. I learned everything just going on the highways.
When I was in my life, I was a school on wheels, basically. That's what I always said. You know, you'd go to a guy. There was always a guy we had in our neighborhood. We called him Jerry. His name wasn't Jerry, but he fought for the Kaiser. And Jerry always had his tonic. And what you could do is you could go, hey, Jerry, if you give me half the tonic right now, look at me in the eyes, Jerry. Jerry, you're beautiful. If you look at me in the eyes right now, and I'll drink, we'd go under the bridge. We'd have ourselves a good time. We could have been sleeping under the Ritz-Carlton for all we cared. We drank that. And, you know, that's what it's about. That's what it's about. Thank you, Governor Kasich.
The next chapter, it's a touch of sentimentality, is called A Whisper from Above.
Yeah, John Kasich is religious in a really weird way, like in a very hobo way. Like he's
very familiar with the Bible because he's had to endure hours of church people reading it at him before he could tuck into his vittles and free soup beans and cornbread. Okay, the next chapter, I swear to God, I'm not making this up. This is the most hobo shit of all time. The next chapter, the second to last one, is called One Pair of Shoes at a Time.
I live my life one pair of shoes at a time. Fast and Furious 8.
That's Fast 8. It's about John Kasich racing a rail car with Vin Diesel.
And finally, the last chapter is called A Sacred Space. It's like a proto safe space is a sacred space.
Yeah, no Coen Brothers movies allowed in there.
Yeah, that's right, motherfucker.
And then finally, there's conclusion, you know, conclusion of the book. But stranger than that is the very last entry in the table of contents. Table of contents just says addresses. It's the addresses of, but it's all written in hobo code and hobo hieroglyphs.
Yeah, the addresses. It's not even the people's names. It's like the lady in the hat, some type of Christian, Cincinnati Joe. Then it's all the aliases that Kasich has used to bounce checks. Joaquin Sanchez, Cuyahoga Johnny,
Ron Mexico,
Carlos Danger, of course.
So yeah, that was John Kasich's book. Courage is contagious. It's like tuberculosis.
Basically. Man, we had some of that going through the old hobo camp. Woo! You don't want to know about it, brother.
Moving on from John Kasich, the other news item this week that I think warrants mentioning is this Chilcot inquiry, the Chilcot report that came out after basically it took them longer than George R. R. Martin takes to write one of his books, the next Game of Thrones book. It took them 7 years to produce this. This was over in the UK, and it was like the big official UK government report on how and why they got involved in the Iraq War. And I gotta say, Chilcot inquiry, more like not chill, not inquiry, relitigating the war in Iraq. God.
Yeah, it's like they say in the success memes, people who dwell on the failure are failing to succeed. If you live in the past, then you will never live in the future.
If you spend all the time looking in the rearview mirror, you're gonna crash.
So it was this massive official report that came out that, you know, faulted the Blair government for basically deciding to go to war far, far earlier than they let on to the British public.
What?
Or even, yeah, it basically had, there's a handwritten note from Blair to Bush from like early 2002 saying, whatever happens, I'm with you.
Do you like me? Yeah. With check. One. Yes. No. Maybe.
Blair's notes to Bush remind me of a certain drifter in Vermont Senate candidate's emails to certain journalists. They have the same tone. President Bush, I want to touch your soul with mine and meld into one.
I think that we could do something beautiful together.
President Bush, is there a chance our souls could go on a journey together to a deep place? And, you know, look, I don't want
to
go through
a self suck video to George Bush.
I think that about sums it up. And I don't think it's worth going through exactly what was in the report. We already know it was a giant fuck up. The Iraq War was a fucking disaster, and they lied about it from the beginning. However, there is one thing of note that I do want to read from the actual report. Now, on the show, we've joked in the past about bending reality to our will, and we've joked about how real-world events are taking on an eerie similarity to movies. And I don't know about you guys, but my brain is broken in such a way that I really can't relate to any world event or just even things in my personal life without finding some analog in film or television. Right?
Totally. Absolutely.
So this is from the Chilcot inquiry. This is absolutely real. This is from section 4.3. And this is an example of, once again, of life imitating art, imitating life, and then back around to movies again. I don't even know how to describe it. But this is 100% real from the Chilcot inquiry. It's from section 4.3. I can put a link up to this in the info, but I'm just going to read from it now. Section 4.3, this is bullet point 130. Quote, In early October, questions were raised with SIS about the mention of glass containers in the 23rd of September 2002 report. It was pointed out that glass containers were not typically used in chemical munitions, and that a popular movie, The Rock, had inaccurately depicted nerve agents being carried in glass beads or spheres. Iraq had difficulty in the 1980s obtaining a key precursor chemical for Soman, a chemical agent. Section 131. The questions about the use of glass containers for chemical agent and the similarity of the description to those portrayed in The Rock had been recognized by SIS. There were some precedents for the use of glass containers, but the points would be pursued when further material became available. So, in summary, the case for Iraq's chemical war or chemical weapons potential was based on erroneous information gleaned from Michael Bay's The Rock.
How fucking sick is Michael Bay? Michael Bay not only has produced multi-million dollar blockbusters, he produced the multi-trillion level blockbuster, multi-trillion dollar blockbuster, The War in Iraq.
I mean, what the hell does this mean? Does this mean that some like British functionary in MI6 or something is like, They got glass balls filled with chemicals, don't they? It's also that in the movie once. That's got to be true, right?
Well, no. It was in the UK's dossier about Iraq's chemical weapons. They described Saddam's chemical weapons as being the nerve agents being stored in glass
right.
beads.
So somebody made
exactly
that up,
like in the
presumably.
Movie The Rock. So yeah, someone just made it up. I just want to read one more thing. This is another bullet point from the Chilcot inquiry. It says, however, it drew attention to the fact that the source's description of the device and its spherical glass contents was, quote, remarkably similar to the fictional chemical weapon portrayed in the film The Rock. It acknowledged the similarity had been pointed out by one recipient when the report of the 23rd of September was circulated. That significantly changed the context in which the details were subsequently presented in the reissued report. So, again, this is like they're borrowing from Michael Bay's The Rock. But this entire exchange about how the chemical weapons are made up and based on the movie The Rock is straight the fuck out of In the Loop. Like the Iannucci quotient is getting dangerously it's reaching critical mass. There you remember though, there's a scene in the Loop where they have a debate over like the 20-year-old like Heritage Foundation intern who's been put in charge of the White House Iraq policy to liaise with the British. He has a debate with his boss over what kind of movies can be shown to the troops.
Well, I don't want to be accused of micromanaging, but I cannot understand why I Heart Huckabees is on a list of DVDs considered suitable for armed forces entertainment. That self-indulgent crap is not suitable for combat troops.
Well, I just got off the phone with Linton, who proceeded to bitch me out for allowing I Heart Huckabees in the troops' DVD roster. Yeah. You know that phrase, I'm too old for this shit? Well, I'm too young for this shit, you know?
To get a little more specific here, not only do we have this tangent from the British, but it's an established fact that after 9/11, Michael Bay and other Hollywood blockbuster producers and directors were contacted by the Pentagon to brainstorm potential Al-Qaeda threats. That actually happened. So there are reports banging around the Pentagon saying about, like, what happens if a bunch of mutated turtles try to take over the Super Bowl or something like that? You know, what if cars can transform into robots and decide to convert to Wahhabist Islam? I mean, those reports exist somewhere in the Pentagon.
Megatron is Shia.
Oh, don't get me started, dude. I have an entire theory that the Transformers series, at least the first four movies, or the first three movies, not the one with Mark Wahlberg, the Shia LaBeouf trilogy, are actually about the U.S. response to the Sunni-Shia conflict after 9/11. But anyway, that's for another time.
We'll save that for the next Michael Bay movie we discuss
in
the show.
To answer your question, yes, Megatron. Megatron is Shia because the Decepticons are Iran and they're Shia allies, and Optimus and the Autobots are Saudi Arabia and the Sunni Gulf states. So, just so everyone knows.
Well, actually, let's just discuss this. Let's break down the Transformers theory, because I seem to remember in the second Transformers movie, like presumably in the real world, Obama had become president, and like the sort of U.S. national security state in that movie had sort of turned their back on the Transformers.
And they actually
and they didn't want to be associated with them.
Who's the national security advisor for Obama, too. They say him by name, so it's not just some president. It's Obama. And he's this simpering bitch who's like, you guys, we need to negotiate with the Decepticons. You guys just cause more problems than you're worth. And at one point, Josh Duhamel straps Josh Duhamel throws a parachute at him while they're in a C-130 gunship and just kicks him out of the airplane. Just like, fuck you, excellent. Obama. The whole thing is there. But for me, it really comes down to the third one, because there's a moment in the third one where Decepticons convince humans to turn their backs on the Autobots, the Saudis, and they volunteer to leave Earth in a spaceship, and the spaceship blows up on exit from the Earth's atmosphere, and everyone thinks all the Autobots are dead. Then immediately after that, the Decepticons turn on the humans and destroy Chicago. And then you find out that the Autobots basically faked their own deaths specifically, and it's said in the film, to show the humans how necessary they are. And then they go and they kill all the Decepticons in Chicago. It's basically positing 9/11 sort of as a Saudi coordinated inside job to ratify their centrality to American anti-terrorist policy.
At least one of the Autobots is Mossad, though, right?
Oh, of course. Those connections are deep.
I thought they kind of hammered it into your head when they called him Lion. But yeah. Hey guys, here's my impression. Here's my impression of Obama in the Transformers. Check it out. All right, okay. If you like your Optimus Prime, you can keep it. Thank you, everybody.
But owned. Outside Michael Bay, I guess the other thing that I took note of in the Chilcot inquiry and the reactions to it was David Frum had a couple choice tweet
David
comments
Tom?
About it.
Who?
David Frum, I would say he's Canada's worst export since that flight attendant that was profiled and the band played on. Only 1% of you will get that joke, and that's probably a good thing because I'm already ashamed of it. But David Frum said something along the lines of, good or bad, the UK-US intervention in Iraq offered Iraqis a choice for a better future, and they made the choice for sectarian warfare. So in a way, we can't be blamed.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not quoting it exactly.
You can lead a horse to democracy, but you can't make him drink.
But he basically said the outcome of the war in Iraq is the fault of the Iraqis themselves for choosing to live in a country that was destroyed by the United States and the United Kingdom.
We like, you know, we tell jokes about the Atlantic from time to time because, you
it's
know,
a piece
it's
of shit.
Once respected publication that publishes, you know, just frivolous articles like you might be a pretty bro if, or the new age of hookups. But the Atlantic is nominally a liberal publication, right? Well, the people the Atlantic runs include Jeffrey Goldberg, who refers to Iranian voters as animals in a zoo, and now David Frum. David Frum is he doesn't have the coolness or the boldness of a David Annington or John Yoo. He was
well,
a fucking pablum salesman for a war crime, but he's respected. You know, liberals who read The Atlantic respect him because David Frum is respectable, and he'll say, you know, we need to stand up to Trump, but that's unacceptable. But, you know,
well, he's also for gun control, which is the only issue that matters anymore for these increasingly powerless liberals who sort of fetishize their powerlessness and therefore focus on this issue of guns because it's just a shibboleth that they can point to
and they're
mask
they're not really
the fact
focusing
that they have
on
no the, other commitments besides
they're
this.
Not really focusing on the issue. They're just panicking, going, somebody do something, because if the conservative pathology is false bravado in the face of sexual dementia and just sheer terror at all times, the liberal pathology is that you can only process love through pity and need to faint on a couch in front of everybody at all fucking times. But anyway, David Frum, it's Naked White Man's Burden. This is exactly what he's basically saying. The Mesopotamian skull cannot process democracy. They made the wrong choice. This is what this view of the world is. When it fails, you just go into bizarre racial politics. That's exactly what this fucking asshole who helped kill hundreds of thousands of people is doing. But it's fucking fine.
Look, okay, so we gave training and guns and power drills to Shia militias after we took over Iraq, but we didn't make them use those to torture suspected terrorists among the Sunni population basically at random. That was their choice. We thought they were going to use the power drills to, you know, spruce up their offices. We had no idea what they were going to do with them.
He followed it up with a second comment that I think is almost even worse. And he said, the U.S. and U.K. intervened in Iraq and it turned out bad, but we didn't intervene at all in Syria and it's turned out worse. So who's to say, you know, what's up and down? You know, who's to say what's right and wrong?
Because, of course.
And what's so awful about that is basically the war in Iraq is why Syria has collapsed. Over a million Iraqis fled to Syria because of what David Frum helped do to their country. And once again, he's completely absolving himself and the United States of any responsibility for any of this.
And of course, ISIS started off as Al-Qaeda in Iraq in the immediate aftermath of the invasion.
And a huge portion of ISIS's middle management and upper command are former high-ranking Ba'athist generals. It's so
all of whom were
obvious.
Immediately cashiered and fired with no idea of what to do with them. Paul Bremer putting his combat boots on and going, let's roll, folks. And you're all fired. This will all turn out great. Oh, shit.
I mean, it's just so clueless, but also so cold-blooded. These people like David Frum and everyone else who helped author this, what I've said before is the singular disaster of the 21st century. That is really just a Pandora's box that is going to haunt the world for the next century. They're never going to face any responsibility for it, either to themselves and certainly not any legal.
Well, look at what fucking Tony Blair did after the Chilcot report came out. He had a press conference and I feel very badly about some of the mistakes that were made, but we have to consider what would have happened if we hadn't acted.
Well, that goes right back to our interview with Derek Davison and how for the foreign policy establishment, the sin of not doing something is much worse than the sin of doing
because
something.
Because you can imagine anything. Disaster. Like, even though the manifest results of the invasion of Iraq are 100% negative, massive disaster, humanitarian blood-soaked nightmare, no redeeming features to it whatsoever, except, of course, for the Hurt Locker winning Best Picture, I guess. But in their heads, they can fantasize about something worse if it hadn't happened. And that fantasy that isn't totally in their head and they'll never have to justify it, they'll never have to explain how it's even remotely plausible, is their sucker because no one can ever challenge it because it didn't fucking happen.
Yeah, the fantasy nightmare scenario that they're imagining are those anal beads of nerve agent that from the Rock. And now
Saddam's. Okay. So the invasion of Iraq, bad, didn't work out, you think so? Well, what about the entire East Coast being turned gay by a gay bomb deployed by Saddam's chemical weapons program?
But what is David Frum's and Tony Blair's conceit to the Iraq War? That, you know, after this all turned out to be a load of shit, they sort of defaulted to the neoconservative, to the most retarded possible interpretation of Strauss you could have, which is we had to struggle against evil to create the democracy. What has Tony Blair done since he left office? He has been in the employ of Gulf states, fucking Abdel El Sisi, who is fucking caught more Muslim Brotherhood bodies than any French commandos retaking the Grand Mosque in Saudi Arabia could ever fucking dream of. he's done everything he can to squeeze money out and reify tyrannical powers in the Middle East.
I think the Central Asia too, right? Like, isn't he on some of the, like, Uzbekistan and all that shit? He's on that. He's on the Josh Faust.
The Josh Faust.
Yeah, he's with Nazi. Him and Josh Faust can fucking snuggle up.
He probably has. And the thing with them is, like, you know, they can look at the disaster that Iraq has turned into, or all their dreams and how they've turned out in reality. And, you know, and Frum has since become sort of a conservative apostate.
This guy who helped sell the destruction of any progress with Iranian relations for at least 10 years, who fucking turned Iraq into a bloodbath, a civil war that will last probably 100 fucking years at least. He's throwing up his hands in despair at guns just like me. He's just as good as me. Hey, who gives a fuck? None of us care about policy. None of us care about any actual outcome. As long as you're doing our stage performance of falling on the couch and crying and ultimately doing nothing, you're just
because as good as gun us. Control isn't well. Gun control is never about the issues, as you said. It's about signaling which side you're on and whether you have delicate moral sensibilities or whether you're a knuckle dragger. And that matters more than anything else. So no matter how much blood is on David Frum's hands, the fact that he's sophisticated enough to be disgusted by gun violence in America makes him one of us.
David Frum is more of a con man than anything. And his ability to just to continue to the more years, every single year that David Frum gets to exist in this Atlantic liberal media space is another year that he's removed from his crimes in the eyes of his readers. And
Felix, he's already been removed from those crimes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, nobody cares. Nobody cares. And the worst thing about people like David Frum to me is that, like I said, no matter how badly it all turns out or no matter how much blood is on his hands, he can always retreat into this, like, myth of his own noble intentions. You know what I mean? Like, you can just always say, we meant well, but sadly, the Iraqis just couldn't see what we were trying to do. And just, again, diffuse blame entirely and never really face up to the consequences or gravity of what he's done by, again, just retreating into the original fantasy that what they were trying to do was so good and they wanted to make the world a better place.
He's such a good grifter that he literally used white. He literally just channeled a less competent writer version of Rudyard Kipling, talking about this Asiatic skull and how they can't process democracy like a white Westerner. But these fucking he sold this shit to these white liberals so well they don't even fucking notice.
Yeah, and you know
they don't want to.
And I guess we've spoken about it before, but, like, you know, the Iraq War, I'm sure for us and probably most of the people who are listening to us, was really, like, it was the definitive moment probably of our lifetime.
Indeed.
You know, and...
And I should add, has immunized, hopefully, most of us from any of these paeans to elitism and expertise that are now getting bandied about in the face of right-wing populist insurgencies. These people are like, oh, well, the elites are elite for a reason. You're Josh Sparrows of the world. Because we've seen what elites do. We've seen what insane fantasies they can tell themselves. And then how they can justify it afterwards.
Yeah, Josh, elites are elites for a reason. And the reason is that they were born that way.
Like you, you fucking legacy case, no talent asshole.
I guess hopefully to put a bow on this, you know, I was thinking this week about the Chilcot inquiry, which just gave me cause again to just rethink again about the Iraq War, which now seems like so fucking long ago. But like I said, we'll be living with the consequences of it forever, easily till I'm dead. And it's just like I never expected anyone would really like go to jail or preferably be put in front of a fucking firing squad over this. But in my opinion, like the fact that we've just moved on and like, you know, George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney are still out fucking slapping backs and writing books and shit. And David Frum has a column in The Atlantic. And the fact that they're going to die that we're just going to go on like that just to me proves that we're not even a real fucking country. Like, I don't even know. Like, it's not even like none of this is real anymore. It's just like, how can we do that? We just do something like that. And then it's just like it's gone. It's just nothing could possibly.
It's a calcified leadership that cannot be penetrated.
If there's no consequence to lying about a war or knowing, as many Democrats did, that the intelligence was faulty and going along with it out of sheer terror of losing a temporary piece of power, and you experience zero consequence for it, what is the point in this current system that defeats every single fucking purpose of it?
I have to say, okay, there is one, for me, there is one, to this week anyway, there was one little light, it's one small little glimmer of light and warmth.
And it comes from Old Blighty, where the Chilcot report was issued. And as infuriating as that report was, and the smug, dismissive responses to it by the people who were responsible for the war in Iraq, watching the failed coup against Corbyn by the Blairites in the Labour Party, it was incredibly satisfying to me, because that it just showed that maybe there's a little bit of hope, possibly, that we can get some sort of mechanism for accountability in place. Because so these guys are all sharp ass political operators. These are the people, they basically worship their own cunning and ruthlessness and their willingness to do anything to get ahead, and they've all justified to themselves why they have to do that. So they're totally just certain with it. And they all got together in their little witch's coven and decided that they were going to overthrow this doddering old socialist grandpa who everyone knows is not really much of a political strategist. And all of their backroom shenanigans, all of their House of Cards, Game of Thrones politicking just failed because the majority of Labour members wanted to keep Corbyn. So these guys are doing all this shit in back rooms. Meanwhile, Corbyn is like literally lost in his garden and trying to like get an orange peel off for the entire week. You know, not doing anything to stop them, not countering them with any Frank cards, Tyrion Lannister counter moves. Just like, oh, bloody hell, I can't find. Where's the bin? Oh, bollocks. But because the massive Labour voters were like, no, fuck you, we're for Corbyn, they just fucking, it all blew up and they collapsed and they had nothing. And just seeing all of that smug connivance just fail in the face, not of superior strategizing, because we all know Corbyn's not really much of a political operative, just by the fact that there were too many people who supported him. And just that the failure of that model of politics, which if we talked about it on the show repeatedly, has dominated both parties in the U.S. and in Europe, just fail. It was awesome. I was like a baby cyclo on a diet of straight tobacco.
That's a hopeful note to really wrap things up here.
That was pretty dark. I just wanted to give us a little bit of something to
Leave an up note, and here's another up note. Do you like to laugh, people? Do you like comedy? Then if so, come to Philadelphia on July 28th, where we'll be doing a live show with our buddies, our partners, our brothers, Street Fight, July 28th, Philadelphia, the Democratic National Convention. Be there or be square.
We fucking love Street Fight. I know we say it from time to time, but I don't feel like we say it enough. When I was when I had my bouncing job in Minnesota that I fucking hated, I felt like it was insane because, you know, I imagine a lot of you guys work like fucking jobs you hate. Like every job I've had before what I do now, I fucking hated. And I felt like I was insane because people don't talk about what a shitty thing that is to work this low end job and be at the mercy of customers and
hasn't watched enough Mike Rowe.
Yeah, yeah. Who hate this micro viewpoint. You just feel insane because people don't openly talk about how ridiculous this is. And the only thing that kept me sane was listening to fucking Street Fight when I would walk home from the bar at 3 a.m. And we fucking love those guys. And if you don't,
Chapo wouldn't exist if we hadn't talked about Benghazi on Street Fight.
Yeah, if you guys don't fuck with Street Fight and also listen to us, you should definitely fucking listen to Street Fight because we love them, they rule, and they're the reason we exist.
Yeah, the live show is going to be awesome. Advanced tickets and official t-shirts for the event are available now. We'll put a link up to that in the info for the show. But definitely, if you're a fan of ours and you're in Philadelphia or the Northeast, we'd love to have you come out, see the show, and hang out with us.
And to amend what Will said earlier, I think more accurately, be there and be square.
Exactly. One other thing, we haven't done it. We didn't do it last week. The mailbag feature. I'm going to save that till our next member show. But please do keep the letters coming. We are checking them. I haven't put it together for this week's show, but definitely keep the letters to chapotraphouse@gmail.com coming through. I'm sorry I haven't gotten to them since then, but we want to keep doing it. So please. please keep sending us your questions, comments, hate, anything.
Oh, wow. I would really hate it if one of our female listeners photoshopped me at 1/100th of my size and made a video of her pretending to stomp on me. It's not like that's a fetish that I have or anything. Wow, I would really hate that if somebody sent that to chapotraphouse@gmail.com.
Okay. So before we go, there's one last little gem for you guys, and this is something that was inspired by Matt. Something you tweeted this week,
yeah? Because Ross Gotthardt is losing his mind.
Yes, exactly. The context for this is our good old friend Ross Douthat. True fans of the show will remember him way back from episode 3, where we did probably our most famous reading series to date about his sailboat trip with Bill Buckley. Probably our most famous reading series, probably still the best in my opinion. So Ross Douthat, as of late, his tweets have taken on a sort of a very dark, mournful cast as he comes face to face with the fact of Trump. And the broader fact that nobody really gives a shit about the orthodox conservatism that, he uses as a mask for his deep-seated sexual insecurity and fear.
It's actually, like, the best writing he's ever done.
Well, I'm looking at one tweet he has, and it just says, "The houses are all gone under the sea. The dancers are all gone under the hill. Oh, dark, dark, dark. They go all into the dark." And that is the best thing Ross has ever written, because it's actually it's T.S. Eliot. So good job, Ross. He has another one that said, "The abandoned church in this story is a reminder that history's author doesn't always go in for subtlety." And it's a link to a story, the title of which is "Internet Porn Nearly Ruined His Life. Now He Wants to Help." And I swear to God.
I just imagine him like going to Brazzers and just yelling the Second Coming by Yeats at the top of his lungs while doing so.
He sees the bank bus drop by, and he does Harvey Keitel at the end of the of Bad Lieutenant.
Bad Lieutenant.
I don't know. I'm so fucking weak.
I do want to mention this New York Times article that Ross shared. Like I said, it's called "Internet Porn Nearly Ruined His Life. Now He Wants Help." This is in the styles section of the men's styles section of the Times. And it's a photo of the guy, and he looks sort of like a ginger Jesse Eisenberg with a weird scraggly beard. But I swear to God, the profile is of the guy who founded the NoFap group on Reddit. And it's now become a movement. It's become a NoFap movement. And this guy said he was a loser who couldn't relate to women because of his internet porn addiction. But it says he was jacking off to porn 14 times a day.
Jesus Christ. I consider myself like at least like a semi-professional masturbator, and that's insane.
And I'm just saying, like, if you're jacking off 14 times a day, internet porn or not, yeah. I don't think internet porn is the issue. I think it's something else.
If that guy had been around at the turn of the century, he would have been like fucking butter churns on the family farm.
But in the article, it mentions that he now has an office space that is that he's renting office space in what is now a desanctified Catholic church. And there's something about this former wastrel now leading a crusade against masturbation in the desanctified Catholic church basement. There's something about that struck Ross just very deeply and triggered kind of a deep, mournful sadness in him. And that combined... It's that
he put on an extra hair shirt after he read that.
It's that kind of sorrow that is pervading Ross that it triggers that, and the fact that he is now a running joke online because being compared to Ralph Wiggum for everything he says.
The best account. By the way,
shout out to Ralph Douthat.
That's so good.
Shout out to Ralph Douthat.
Ralph Douthat is so good.
So yeah, Ross is in a bad place now. And Matt, you had a tweet that Ross was reciting the Tears in the Rain monologue from Blade Runner to 40 different cam girls.
Yeah, I just imagine him doing that. I just imagine him finally like going, if this is where the culture is leading, and then going on like this hardcore style expedition into the another world of cam. Of cam websites and just like basically having a short circuit and freaking out.
So inspired by that, I have written the Roy Batty's Tears in the Rain monologue delivered by Rutger Hauer at the end of the film Blade Runner, I've created a Ross Douthat version. So I'm going to perform it for you now. Here we go. I've seen things you New York Times readers wouldn't believe. Bill Buckley's ass cheeks on fire off the shoulder of the Long Island Sound. I watched chunky Reese Witherspoons glitter lustfully in the dark in the Tannhauser basement. The timeless glamour of classic beauties like Audrey Hepburn, Marilyn Monroe, and Marlena Dietrich pass into the tawdry trollops of today. I've seen inscrutable Asians cluster together in Ivy League dining halls and been forced to order dinner by a corpulent Supreme Court justice after eating nearly 60 oysters. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in the rain. Time too fat.
It's a shame she's on the pill. But then again, who isn't?
Peace.
Bye-bye.
Peace.
The reason why I should be president is... Great question. The reason why I should be president, I feel like I have to,
Excuse me. 2 days ago, he said he would take his pants off and moon everybody. Nasty guy. He's a nasty guy.
Under President Jeb Bush.
Hey, it'll never happen.
Need a weak person being president of the United States? Okay,
you can. You flew in. You can. You flew in with your 767, didn't you?
Hey, I don't care.
The real con artist is Senator Marco Rubio. This little guy. I keep hearing that he's the only one that can beat me, but he's getting beaten very, very badly. So where does this come from?
What are you gonna do with the doo-doo? With the doo-doo.